Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collective works of Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I am Annie A.K.
And I am Jessie.
And today we're talking about chapters 31 of 235 of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Oh, Jessie, these are chapters.
These are like the chapters of Pride and Prejudice. Like when you think about Pride and Prejudice, you think about these chapters.
Absolutely. And I cannot wait to dig into them with you. But before we get into that, it has been a while since we've done this, hasn't it?
I know, but I'm excited. Like what chapters, like these are like the best chapters to get back into with you. So I'm excited.
They really are. But first, since we've probably had some time to actually catch up on some things, what have you been reading, watching, paying attention to in general?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of touched on this the last time we spoke when all this was beginning. It's been sort of hard to get into the mental space for a lot of the stuff that I had originally wanted to read. I maybe wanted to read stuff that was a little bit heavier, and I just really can't deal with that right now. So I've been reading a lot of like romance and a lot of lighter stuff, but one of the books that I picked up is Veronica Roth's new book. Veronica Roth wrote the Divergent series, mm-hmm. if you remember. Oh, yeah. And she's like our age. I actually went to college with her, although she was like a year under me. We were in different circles, but I liked the first Divergent book and I liked her other series that she had after. But this book is her new like adult book. I like put it in quotes because I didn't really see that much of a difference between like adult books and young adult books a mm-hmm. lot of the times. So I think the categories are a little fishy. This one, it's called Chosen Ones. And it has to do with a group of chosen ones post sort of doing what they were chosen to do. And I enjoyed it a lot. You know, one of them is addicted to drugs. You know, one of them is an influencer on social media and the press is after them. And like some of them are dating. And it's very interesting to see the dynamics, you know, like Harry Potter, like after he was chosen to kill Voldemort, like what happened after. And it took a few turns that I was surprised about, and it lost me a little bit in the middle of it, but it wrapped up really well at the end. And so if you like sort of that Chosen One stuff, this is sort of a good flip on it, an mm-hmm. interesting take, even though it did sort of become like another Chosen One story. I've also been working my way through the Alana series, or the Song of the Lioness series. I think it's meant for like younger readers, even though there is like a fair amount of sex in it.
Yeah.
But it's by Tamara Price, and I just totally missed it while growing up. But a lot of our friends have been talking about it recently. And so I was like, oh, like a badass woman who wants to be a knight and disguises herself as a boy and trains for it and rides a horse. Like, yeah, this is like absolutely what I want. And like, oh, there's magic. She has a cat. Like, absolutely. And I read the first two books out of the four, and I'm waiting for the rest from the library. But they've been a joy to read. They've been really fast to read. Like I said, it's about a young girl who disguises herself as a boy in order to become a knight. And you meet her and you meet her friends and you go along with her on her adventures. And it's been a lot of fun. And I can't wait to read the other books. So highly recommend if that sounds like something you might want to read.
Those books have been on my to read list for so long. I think I do owe them somewhere. I actually saw Tamara Pierce speak at the National Book Festival, Book Fair at the National Mall one year. I think it was like the first year I ever went. She's this slightly older lady. She walked up real slow. Everyone was so quiet just watching her, and you know that she had fans of all ages in the crowd, and she's just like, hello everyone. Just real slow.
That's so cool.
Yeah, but like you after a while
yeah
you saw all these people like leaving, and she'd be like, where are you going? And then they'd like leave and she'd go, those dopes fall for it every time. And she just like, she's so animated and lovely and hilarious and sweet and funny. And it made me really want to read those books. So maybe this will be the year.
Yeah. But what else? What are you reading now?
So last time I said I was going to read two books, or I planned on starting two books, one called If I Never Met You. I mispronounced very McFarlane's name because it's spelled with an M and an H, but it's a very, very, very something like that, McFarlane, which is a little romantic comedy kind of thing, a fake relationship and workplace scenario. I haven't gotten too far into it, but so far it's cute. It hasn't hooked me yet, but mm-hmm. everyone's very charming. The main character has in the very first conversation she's involved in the book, someone's just like, where are you from? And she's like, I'm from Yorkshire, like my accent says. And she's like, but where are you from? And then gesture to their face. And you're like, I'm relating to you already. So I'm in. I actually just started. Yay. Most of the time I mention a book on this thing and say, I plan on reading this. And then I don't. So I'm very proud of myself for actually picking it up. The other one is Minor Feelings by Kathy Park Hong. A lot of it is mostly just sort of autobiographical and essay nonfiction about her experience as an Asian American. And you never want to read anything or put too much faith in anything that kind of wants to describe a certain experience, because, you know, Asian America isn't one like uniform monolith thing. But sometimes it's just enough to hear someone else having like similar moments as you, good and bad, all the moments that you're kind of like, oh, that's like crazy that that's a thing, or like, wow, that was a terrible time. I was a terrible person. And it's nice to, it resonates with you when someone is like, even just struggling as much as you are, is trying to figure things out. So I'm enjoying it. It's kind of funny. It's mostly just very personal and hard. And a third book, because it has been a while since we've done this.
Very nice.
Yes. Finally back on this reading thing. Like you said, it's been not always very easy to feel like reading, let alone something a little more difficult. So I looked at those two books that I plan to read and I went, not yet. And I picked up Mackenzie Lee's Loki Where Mischief Lies, which I think I have talked about on this pod before. Definitely not what I would call too heavy. It is, well, like you said, it's probably really easy to call it YA, but it's in a fuzzy kind of period. And Mackenzie Lee did write A Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue, which I think tend to fall into the YA category. But at the same time, this is set like only a couple months before the opening events of the first Thor movie. So not babies, not little teens. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I think when I first started it, I complained it wasn't bisexual enough, because Loki swims in heeled boots that could kill someone. And I was like, well, that's a promise that they've broken to me now. But there is a little kissing later. There's actually multiple kissings. Not enough actual making out, though, which some Marvel fans may disagree with me, and they would be wrong. There could always be more making out. So it's been fun. It's I guess I should actually talk about what it is about. It's just a fun kind of murder mystery set on Midgard. But don't think it's not like Loki not being the sad boy that he is. Because, as always, he is our favorite sad boy who likes to cause trouble. And also, I just really, really have to talk about how much I love the show Never Have I Ever on Netflix.
I just started it, like, today, and I'm five episodes in. So when I saw this on the outline, I was like, yes, like, absolutely, like, hit me with it.
It's so charming. And, like, sometimes I give some time for a show that Netflix is like, this is our number one watch show right now. But the little preview was so cute. And the main lead, whose name I don't know, I'm very sorry, plays Davy. She's just a nerdy girl who is dealing with the death of her father and being incredibly goofy and dorky and not popular. There's like a little concern I had that it may fall into some usual tropes that we've seen from other Netflix shows, like To All the Boys I've Loved, Dead Parent, Fake Romance, that whole thing. But it turns a lot of things on its head. It definitely has its own voice. It adds just a lot of the characters really fantastic. I really love the mom. She's so good. The therapist is really amazing. Her friends, her arch nemesis, and the guy that she is super into, as well as his sister, just really fantastic performances, really great characters. I cried so hard at the end, though.
Like, oh, really?
Sobbing, oh, no. Crying through tears. I'm like, I don't like this.
Oh,
I felt
no.
So much. But it was super worth it. I really liked it, and I can't wait to hear what you think about it. Also, Sendhil Ramamurthy, whose name I have bothered to remember because he is so beautiful, is so beautiful. He's so beautiful.
Oh, I mean, he's
still
gorgeous.
So beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, everyone on there, like, her, the actress that plays her cousin that lives with her is, like, stunning. But it's really funny because, like, when the show started, I was like, oh, yeah, this is, like, super diverse cast or whatever. And that's, like, awesome, and I love everybody. And I was like, this is a high school in Sherman Oaks. Like, there's definitely going to be one Jewish character, right? And then you meet her, like, nemesis. And I was like, yeah, like, I know this kid. Like, I am this kid. And I texted a mutual friend of ours that I knew that was watching the show, and I mentioned, I was like, I just started. Is it okay if I'm, like, shipping her in this Ben character? And she's like, yeah, it's okay if you ship them together. I was like, okay. Yeah, I was like, I didn't want it to get, like, icky.
You're not problematic. Except, yeah, you know, that they're constantly at odds, but they're also so alike. So why wouldn't you?
Enemies to lovers is, like, my catnip, so.
I mean, they're enemies that had, like, I don't know, maybe I should mention, I don't know if you got into this part yet.
I'm halfway through the series, so.
Have you gotten to the Model UN part?
Yeah. I watched Model UN. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so they have guidelines about their nemesis ship. So, like, how could you not love that?
Oh, I absolutely love it. I was like, yep, this kid, I know him so well.
That's been fun. Yeah, so we've obviously been filling up our time at home.
Yes, so, but there's a lot of good stuff out there, thankfully, to keep us distracted.
So to everyone who's like, art and entertainment isn't important, we should be paying more attention and celebrating all the other people, I'm like, yeah, that's great. I mean, it's a little self-serving for me to be like, yay, essential workers being one. But all these people who are creating stuff, they're the ones who've been keeping us sane throughout all this time. So shout out to them for doing good work.
Yes, absolutely.
Do we want to read that email?
Yes. So we got a fantastic email from our friend Tiffany, right?
Yes. Oh, it was such a good email that we had to share it with you guys. Some Charlotte and Wickham thoughts. We love it when you guys email because you guys bring in like other perspectives, because I think we get a little stuck in our bubbles sometimes. I know that I've been real stuck on, how do I want to put this? Just like really exploring or investigating how I feel about certain characters who fit into more negative stereotypes. But maybe we're both a little too kind to some people.
Mm-hmm. No, it's good to hear a different perspective because we sort of, when you like have an idea in your head and everything sort of reinforces that idea. So it's good to get another perspective. So thank you so much for writing in, Tiffany.
It's almost like we're prejudiced towards some of the characters.
Annie.
So in conflict between Elizabeth and Charlotte, I do think it's entirely possible that there is some internalized misogyny at play where Elizabeth just offers more leniency to men over women. But I always took the main reason for Elizabeth's feeling about Charlotte and Mr. Collins is more about Elizabeth wanting Charlotte in her Mr. Collins mockery club. I think the interactions with Mr. Bennett and Elizabeth show that they both relish in the absurdity of others. And it seems so Elizabeth was hoping to Charlotte would join in with her on expressing annoyance with him. I also felt like Elizabeth maybe felt isolated and not supported in her choice to turn him down when her friend doesn't seem to share her view that the man is unmarriable. Ultimately, I viewed a lot of this as revealing a part of Charlotte that Elizabeth was previously not aware of and feeling a loss of connection over it. I think this type of change in friends is so relatable, and I really love that it's followed up by Elizabeth getting used to the state of things and coming to terms with the new state of their friendship. I find it all too common that friendships can change dramatically when they jump into a serious relationship, especially with someone you don't really care for. And it's nice to see that it doesn't need to be the end of the friendship. Fully agree, Tiffany.
Mm-hmm.
With Wickham, I wanted to touch on two things you all mentioned, how much Elizabeth liked him and why she's willing to give him so much a pass for iffy behavior. And I think the answer has everything to do with Darcy. Mm-hmm. I don't think we really get a sense of how Elizabeth has fared with men in the past, but it seems like the attention she gives to Wickham is somewhat unique, despite the fact that he doesn't really seem to have any unique qualities. So I think the main reason she likes him at all is that his account of Darcy makes her feel better about discrediting his character, which makes her feel better about the initial rejection. I also think she's quick to forgive his behavior because condemning his behavior means that he's less credible in his account about why Darcy sucks. She might even feel some kind of kinship in viewing both of them as victims of Darcy's arrogance. I feel like her ease at letting him go as a partner paired with her difficulty in calling him out indicates to me that she cares more about his story and character than any kind of romantic attachment. Good. I love both those things so much.
Oh, no, that's great.
The kind of betrayal, I guess, that Elizabeth feels from maybe not having as strong an idea of who Charlotte is and what her beliefs are, what her priorities are, I think is a very, very important point to be bringing up.
Mm-hmm.
And as for Wickham, yeah. I mean, they seem to have like a good rapport, but it is more of a into the idea of Wickham and his beautiful face, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And flattering. Like, he's like this good looking guy. I loved the internalized misogyny thing that she had, that she brought up about the Charlotte and Elizabeth dichotomy. And so, you know, as badass and feminist and to dilute it down to basic terms that we find Elizabeth, like, she is living in this patriarchal society. She's living in this world where, you know, you do have to kind of find a husband. Mm-hmm. And I think it's easy to be flattered by the very handsome man and let him sort of feed into your own prejudice, and it just becomes even more self-fulfilling. So I love that.
Yeah, especially, yeah, I mean, we can pretty much make a case. We can make a case that basically every woman in this book is a victim of the patriarchy, but at the same time, that doesn't necessarily absolve how some of the women behave.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I would like it to.
No, yeah, and it makes sense for us to, as much as we love Elizabeth, like, it makes sense for us to be critical of her and to sort of understand, you know, like, why she thinks the way she does in the bubble that she's in, how we look at it with a more modern sensibility, but then how it also compares to the other women that are in her circle. Because she's, like, willfully blind at sometimes. Like, she has her faults. And I think that's something that we really liked when we went into Sense and Sensibility, how even our favorite characters had these flaws that kind of came out, and no one was sort of perfect. And it's easier in Pride and Prejudice, maybe, because we're more familiar with it, because we might like Elizabeth's character more than mm-hmm. any other female protagonist that we've come across, to sort of be blind to a lot of her flaws when they're literally, like, right in the title of the book.
As much as it'd be nice to think that Jane Austen is completely infallible, there are sometimes I just have general problems with some of the characters she writes and the ones she glorifies, and then the ones that society is like, yay, aren't they great? Like Mr. Bennet, you know, we've not been super kind on him, but he's always thought to be like the warm father figure, but only to like two of his daughters. Mm-hmm. And he's always just like kind of cuddly in adaptations and things, but he sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good for us to kind of have that reality check on everybody, and mm-hmm. cut, and as well as like cut some people some slack and have a nuanced take on everyone, except Wickham, who sucks.
Yeah, oh, he does suck. He may be beautiful, but he sucks. And we've got another letter or email from another friend of ours, Tasia, about Mrs. Bennet, but it has spoilers, so we're saving it. And it's definitely a nice counterpoint to all the moments we've been like, well, Mrs. Bennet kind of has a reason for being the way she is, but we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that was great. Thank you so much for writing in, Tiffany. We love you. And
we love hearing from you.
But yeah.
All right. So back to the matter at hand.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. But before we get to that, let's just review. It has been a while, at least for us, since we have caught up with the Bennets and their many shenanigans, leading up to chapters 31 to 35. Previously on, at the same time, Elizabeth is given some good advice from her aunt, Miss Gardner, about not falling for the charms of Mr. Wickham. Poor Jane learned some rough lessons, as not only does she not run into Mr. Bingley while in London, but she comes face to face with Caroline Bingley's frosty other side, and she must admit that Caroline was not a real friend. Elizabeth decides to honor her promise to Charlotte and comes to visit her marital home in Hunsford, along with Charlotte's father and sister Maria. She arrives to find that Mr. Collins hasn't changed one bit, but Charlotte has made quite the life for herself and is able to impress Elizabeth in the way that she deals with her ridiculous husband. Elizabeth finally gets to meet the esteemed Lady Catherine de Bourgh and her daughter, and finds her proud woman and her daughter not much to write home about. Darcy and his cousin Fitzwilliam also come to visit, and something is brewing at Rosings.
A lot of setup there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And watch as these dominoes fall.
Oh, right. So we start our reading for this week when Elizabeth is invited yet again to Rosings, and the dashing Colonel Fitzwilliam pays special attention to her during dinner. After the meal, she plays the pianoforte and pokes fun at Darcy, informing Colonel Fitzwilliam of his very bad behavior at the Meryton Ball, at which he refused to dance with her. Lady Catherine then lectures Elizabeth on the proper manner of playing the instrument, forcing her to remain at the keyboard until the end of the evening. The next day, Darcy shows up at the parsonage and tells Elizabeth that Bingley is unlikely to spend much of his time at Netherfield Park in the future. The rest of their conversation is super awkward, and when Darcy departs, Charlotte declares that he must be in love with Elizabeth, or he would have never called in such an odd manner. In the days that follow, both Darcy and his cousin visit frequently, and eventually Charlotte muses that maybe it's Colonel Fitzwilliam who's interested in Elizabeth. Elizabeth encounters Darcy and his cousin frequently on her walks throughout the countryside. During one conversation, Colonel Fitzwilliam mentions that Darcy claims to have recently saved a friend from an imprudent marriage. Elizabeth conjectures that the friend was Bingley, and the imprudent marriage was a marriage to Jane. She views Darcy as the agent of her sister's unhappiness. Alone at the parsonage, it's a very hard word to pronounce, Elizabeth really is still mulling over what Fitzwilliam has told her when Darcy enters and abruptly declares his love for her. Okay. His proposal of marriage dwells at length upon her social inferiority, and Elizabeth's initially polite rejection turns into an angry accusation. She demands to know if he sabotaged Jane's romance with Bingley, and he admits that he did, and she then repeats Wickham's accusations and declares that she thinks Darcy to be proud and selfish, and that marriage to him is utterly unthinkable, and he grimly departs. The next day, Elizabeth takes a walk and runs into Darcy again, who gives her a letter. He walks away and she begins to read. In the letter, Darcy again admits to breaking up Bingley's romance with Jane, but he defends himself by arguing that Jane's attachment to his friend was not yet strong enough and would eventually lead to heartbreak. He adds that he did not wish Bingley to involve himself with the social encumbrance of marrying into the Bennet family, with its lack of both wealth and propriety. In relation to Wickham, the letter states that Darcy did provide for him after his father's death, and that the root of their quarrel lay in an attempt by Wickham to elope with Darcy's sister Georgiana in the hopes of obtaining her fortune. And that's how we leave our friends.
Can you imagine if somehow that last chapter wasn't in this section of books?
I know. I was like, thank God we like did it like this, because if he had just ended it with her leaving, we would have been like dying to be like, but what happened next? Anyway,
it's like the come down from that chapter would have been so hard.
I know. It was like the perfect ending spot for this week.
Oh, it was quite a time trying to just distill everything, because everything in these chapters is so good and so much fun.
And it's very interesting the way that, I mean, I've read this a number of times, but it's still interesting. Every time I read it, I think I like discover a different part of it, or like I remember it differently. And we'll get into it. But yeah, it's a joy to read these chapters.
We really get to know Colonel Fitzwilliam in this.
Yeah, you know, Colonel Fitzwilliam is very funny to me, because I remember my first time reading this being like, well, this dude seems great. Like, we just married this guy. What's wrong with him?
He's like the bizarro Darcy, in that he's like pleasant and sociable and not rich.
Yeah, I think he says like, there's a line where he says, Colonel Fitzwilliam seemed really glad to see them. Anything was a welcome relief to him at Rosings, and Mrs. Collins's pretty friend had moreover caught his fancy very much. Mm-hmm, so they, like, get along. Like, he finds her, like, attractive. It's funny, in adaptions, like, he's either cast as, like, he's never cast as, like, super handsome, but he's either, like, a young, like, kind of weird-looking guy, or, like, an old guy. Like, they never, like, cast him as someone just like very handsome. And I get why, but it's funny that he's never really considered a serious threat. I think he's like a second son too, so he like has to marry wealthy.
Yeah. In the Lizzie Bennet, I mean, we'll talk adaptations later, but in the Lizzie Bennet diaries, he's actually like a young, good looking dude who's like a business partner slash friend of Darcy. And he's very charming. I can't remember. He may also be gay. I just watched these. I should know. But he's so much fun, and they have like a really great rapport and friendship. So you're like, oh, you guys get along so well. And I've always wondered about that, because like we've said before, I've never really read the books. So it was fun to see just how involved and how much socializing that he got into with the ladies of the parsonage.
No, that's true. I mean, they're entertained so much with their conversation that even Lady Catherine and Darcy are like, oh, like, what are you guys talking about over there?
Lady Catherine does have major FOMO, though, time.
And even Darcy's like, oh, so what are you guys talking about? His eyes had soon and repeatedly turned towards them with a look of curiosity because they're having such a good conversation.
It's like there's a guy over there that's talking to her. That she seems to enjoy.
I know. And it's like a combination of Rosings kind of being super boring. And Elizabeth being very interesting and pretty.
Yeah, why not?
But then we also get this just fantastic conversation at the piano. I just cannot. Everything about this, the piano talk, it just starts great and it ends great.
I love the teasing that Elizabeth does with Darcy. He comes on over while she's playing and she's like, you mean to frighten me, Mr. Darcy, by coming in all this state to hear me? I will not be alarmed, though your sister plays so well. There's a stubbornness about me that never can bear to be frightened at the will of others. My courage always rises at every attempt to intimidate me.
But what I love too about this is that he straight up insults her and she insults him back and they both laugh about it. He says something like, I've had the pleasure of your acquaintance long enough to know that you find great enjoyment in occasionally professing opinions which in fact are not your own. It's a burn. And then she just laughs heartily at this picture of herself and says, you know, your cousin will give you this very pretty notion of me and teach you not to believe a word I say, for it is provoking for me to retaliate, and such things may come out as will shock you to hear. And he says, I'm not afraid of you, smilingly. It's so flirty, and
at some point they started having fun.
Yeah, exactly.
In their weird game.
Because what they're saying is not nice. They're insulting each other. But that's the best form of flirting.
And even though Fitzwilliam is the person that they're kind of talking at, they're definitely not talking to him. He's not really a part of this conversation.
No.
It's just a means.
Oh, it's every part of this conversation is just, every part is fantastic and iconic. I know you and I were joking that we wrote down every quote from this chapter.
But we're not really joking.
No, we're not. And she's like, he danced only four dances. I'm sorry to pain you, but so it was. He danced only four dances, though gentlemen were scarce, and to my knowledge, more than one young lady was sitting down in want of a partner.
And then he's like, oh, but I don't know anyone at the party other than my friends. And she tells him, true, and nobody can ever be introduced in a ballroom. We couldn't really narrow down any burns because everything is burned in these chapters.
Yeah, I couldn't pick one out.
That might be one.
He goes, I'm ill qualified to recommend myself to strangers. Shall we ask him why a man of sense and education who's lived in the world is ill qualified to recommend himself to strangers? Oh, it's just so evil. And that she's not even talking to him. She's talking over him.
I mean, maybe that's why Fitzwilliam was just like, oh, she's really pretty, but I'm not getting involved in whatever's happening here. Yeah. I'm going to just be friendly.
It's so perfect. And it ends this is one of those things where, you know, I love to read it and I love to picture it in my mind, but it reads sort of like a script because you can see it playing out on TV or in a movie so clearly here because it's just so perfect and the timing is so fantastic.
Just fast clipped, no pauses, just immediately ready to talk about whatever. It's kind of fun because for as little as we get actually see Darcy speak, she can really bring it out of him.
Mm-hmm. And he's clearly enjoying it. They have this exchange where he says, you know, I don't have the talent which some possess of conversing easily with those I've never seen before. And she, you know, makes the analogy with the piano saying, you know, my fingers do not move over this instrument in the masterly manner, which I see so many women do. But then I've always supposed it my own fault because I would not take the trouble of practicing. And it's such a diss because, you know, she's basically saying okay, well, you know, you don't even try, so, it doesn't matter, you don't even, practice. And then he smiles and says, you're perfectly right, you've employed your time much better, no one admitted to the privilege of hearing you can think anything wanting. We neither of us perform to strangers. And it's, so sexy.
Oh, that was so much fun. And then, of course, Lady Catherine at the end has to be all like, oh, Anne would have been a delightful performer had her health allowed her to learn. She said this three times. And we're like, not now, Lady Catherine.
Lady Catherine.
Not now.
Let them flirt. God.
Flirting is happening. We don't need Anne here. Thank you.
But then, and then Elizabeth like looks at Darcy being like, oh, his cousin who he's meant to be with or whatever is being praised. Maybe he loves her. And she's like, no, like he doesn't really seem to care much about Mr. Berg.
Mm-mm.
But he does care about you, girlfriend. He was smiling at you at the piano. You're telling me you didn't enjoy that, mm-hmm. Elizabeth? You didn't enjoy that, like, flirty banter?
I mean, she loves being challenged. She loves being right. And he gives her a lot of opportunity to try to be right, too.
And I just love, like, there's nothing tense about it. There's nothing mean or mean-spirited. I think she's, mm-hmm. like, trying to goad him, but he just keeps, like, smiling at her. And it's, like, specifically said in the book. He says smilingly. He said smiling. He's enjoying it. He's enjoying their banter. And there's nothing to indicate that she's sort of put off by it.
Yeah. I mean, for all her, like, judgment about how judgy Darcy is, I mean, she can give it back and does throw it back at him just as often. So, I mean, it's like, just chill, girl. Just enjoy the process. It would have been so boring otherwise.
Oh, yeah. It's such a good scene. And it's my favorite scene. And I think it's in, like, every adaptation that I've seen, like, something similar to that moment. And it's just, like, a really good encapsulation of, is it weird if I say, like, them being soulmates? Or, like, or just, like, mm-hmm. their compatibility?
Yeah. It's very, I mean, it's one of like the founding archetypes of this kind of relationship in stories. It's like this and Beatrice and Benedict.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's just fun.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we'll also see a bit later, even in the proposal scene where there is a lot of nastiness and sort of bitterness thrown around. Like, it's not,
oh my goodness,
funny banter. But I think we see it there that there's not a lot of people in Darcy's life, I think, like, talk to him like this.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is, like, fighting back at him in the proposal scene, as we'll see, or just sort of banter back and forth that will challenge him and sort of question his, like, upbringing and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, because it's like, what, you've got his tenants,
mm-hmm.
you have the people who work for him or manage his home, you've got Bingley, who later says that he tends to listen more to Darcy than his own feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Caroline, who just wants to marry him. You've got Lady Catherine, who wants him to marry her daughter. I think being the pushback against him is probably new and exciting for him. That's why he can't stop thinking about her.
Oh, yeah. No, it's such a good scene, and really, it clues in the reader. Even if you don't have, like, later Charlotte being like, girl, he stopped by to see you, like, all this time. Like, he likes you. Even if you don't have that sort of, like, hitting you over the head, you as the reader see just, like, how compatible they are, and you sort of see it building, even though the proposal, I think, is meant to catch us off guard, too.
Mm-hmm. Which, personally, it does.
Oh, yeah, it totally does. Like, it works. But you do get this, like, foreshadowing, because he stops by, and, like, literally the next chapter, it says, to her very great surprise, Mr. Darcy and Mr. Darcy only entered the room. He seemed astonished, too, on finding her alone and apologized for the intrusion. And then he, like, sits down and, like, has a conversation with her. It's a very interesting scene that foreshadows the proposal later when he shows up.
I like how Charlotte's like, what?
Yeah, Charlotte's the best in this scene. I always forget that Charlotte, like, knows everything.
She really does. I just put it in there. Charlotte knows. So he just sort of shows up, and they have this conversation that's kind of like, I mean, it's about, like, Mr. Collins and about Charlotte and how, like, well, she takes care of the place and all those things.
It's so veiled. Like, he's trying to, like, pry to her, like, would you like to be settled? How do you view their relationship?
Mm-hmm.
It's very coded. Like, she's thinking he's being awkward, and he is being awkward, but he's, like, fishing for information.
And at some point, they're arguing over whether 50 miles is a quote-unquote easy distance from Charlotte and her family. He's like, oh, it's so nice, and it's nice that it's so convenient for her. And Elizabeth is like, not everyone has the means where that's an easy distance to travel. And it's like, this is a weird argument you guys are having now. It's not even about the two of you.
And they have this, like, moment where, like, it says Mr. Darcy drew his chair a little towards her and said, you cannot have a right to such very strong local attachment. You cannot always have wanting to been at Longbourn. And she looks surprised, and he has, like, a change of feeling, and he draws back his chair. So he's, like, trying to see, like, would you want to be close to home? Like, what is too far for you? And he's, mm-hmm. like, very engaged. I don't know. There's, like, a body language thing with, like, moving the chair closer to her and then her being surprised and him moving it back. It's very subtle.
It is. And I have that part. But interestingly, in my version, he says to her, it is proof of your own attachment to Hertfordshire. Anything beyond the very neighborhood of Longbourn, I suppose, would appear far. And to me, it was kind of like he was calling her a country bumpkin who couldn't imagine the bigger, wider world. And I was like, that's not nice. That's not a nice way to put that. But like, it could also just him being very objective of like, well, I mean, yeah, you're from a small town and you love where you're from. So like anywhere else probably just seems really far.
Yeah, that's funny that we both have sort of like different readings of it. Because I definitely, for me, like I read it like him fishing for her for information on whether she feels like 50 miles would be too far, whether she would want to be far from home, kind of like seeing, you know, like would she say yes to like living with me further. I don't know.
Somewhere else.
Yeah. I don't know. There's like some body language stuff going on. I mean, when you read the words on the paper, it's like a boring conversation just about like where you live.
He's very cerebral and internal, Darcy. Yeah. Like he's you can tell. I mean, it's very easy to miss it, but you can, if you're paying attention, you can really tell that he's doing a lot of thinking about what mm-hmm. he's taking in as opposed to directly asking things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it ties back to like what he said before in their kind of flirty banter conversation when he says like, I'm ill-equipped to acquaint myself with strangers, you know, like I wanted to be with my own party. And it reads as prideful from mm-hmm. Elizabeth and from everyone else in the room at the Meryton Ball and in the other instances where we saw him around Longbourn. But like, I get it. Like, I'm at parties and I'm not talking to anybody. Like, I'm super socially awkward. Like, I don't want to talk to strangers. And I'm like an educated person of the world, I'd like to think. So it's just sort of funny that it's read as really prideful and he's read as sort of this like stick in the mud. And you laugh along with Elizabeth like, oh, and, you know, a ballroom's like a good place to meet people. But at the same time, he's just sort of socially awkward. And that's something that I can relate to. Yeah, he's just like an awkward dude.
He really is. And he's just, from her perspective, how strange it must be when he just shows up, sits down for a chat with nothing specific in mind. Just like, yeah, Charlotte, Hertfordshire, 50 miles away. Do you like Kent?
Yeah.
Bye.
Here, I'm going to move my chair like super close to you. I don't know. Is it like a propriety thing? Like, is it weird that it's just like the two of them alone in a room together? Like unchaperoned?
No, like we never see any mention of any servants, but I suppose we could assume that there might be some in the home anyways.
I mean, because he does apologize to her for like finding her alone and apologize for intrusion, but then he like pulls up a mm-hmm. chair. So it's like awkward, but it's not, it doesn't seem like untoward. Unmarried man and unmarried woman, like unsupervised in a room. Mm-hmm. I don't know like how stodgy I'm supposed to like feel about it.
Like Charlotte doesn't say anything about it,
yeah,
about the impropriety of it all, but then Charlotte is Charlotte and she's just like, why is he here? And then she tells her, my dear Eliza, he must be in love with you or he would never have called us in this familiar way.
I know, I love that so much because I always forget that Charlotte kind of knows more than she lets on. But then
she's paying attention.
They both sort of like come to the conclusion that they're just like really bored at Rosings. Like they only come because they like can't find anything better to do.
Which seems fair because like what else are you going to do? Hang out with Lady Catherine?
There's like a really funny line that I actually laughed about. I think it's in the beginning of chapter 33. So I'm like jumping ahead a bit, but it says, more than once did Elizabeth in her ramble within the park unexpectedly meet Mr. Darcy, and to prevent it ever happening again, she took care to inform him at first that this was a favorite haunt of hers. How it could occur a second time, therefore, was very odd, yet it did it even a third. He actually thought it necessary to turn back and walk with her. So she's being a little bit naive here, right? Because she's like, I keep running into him, so I'm going to tell him, like, I always come here and he'll want to avoid it. But, like, he has a crush on her. Like, he's going to see.
But he keeps showing up. And then he keeps walking with her. Why does that keep happening? She's like, why isn't he going away? It's like, girl, come on. He's doing it on purpose.
Yeah, it's a very sort of like, I mean, I get that she's like, it's probably a combination of her just like being totally in denial that this man could have feelings for her. Mm-hmm. But still, it's just funny as the reader because you're just sort of thinking like, no, like he clearly likes you.
Something is happening here. Considering just how stuck she is on the notion from the very first time that they encountered each other that he was really not into her. And then they have these almost like fights. So it makes complete sense where she's just like, why would he want to be this polite that he feels he has to walk with me.
But you do have Charlotte being like, well, you must be in love with you. He keeps showing up. But then you also have Charlotte thinking to herself, you know, she watched him whenever they were at Rosings and whenever he came to Huntsford without much success. He certainly looked at her friend a great deal, but the expression of that look was disputable. It was an earnest, steadfast gaze, but she often doubted whether there was much admiration in it. And sometimes it seemed nothing but absence of mind. So mm-hmm. Charlotte is like onto him, and she's the only one that sort of like figures it out. You know, like, he loves you. He keeps stopping by. And she ends up being right, as we find out. But in that moment, she's like watching him, and like his idea of flirting is just like randomly showing up places and looking at her weird.
I do have friends like Charlotte, though, just being like a single woman myself. Mm-hmm. I do have friends who are constantly like, what about that guy? You want to date that guy? You should probably date that guy. What about this guy? I have this other friend who you could date.
Yeah.
And Charlotte is definitely that friend. In her kind schemes for Elizabeth, she sometimes planned her marrying Colonel Fitzwilliam. He was beyond comparison the most pleasant man. He certainly admired her, and his situation in life was most eligible. But to counterbalance his advantage, Mr. Darcy had considerable patronage in the church, and his cousin could have none at all.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Fitzwilliam is a second son, so he doesn't really have a lot going for him other than presumably a military circumstance. But she's just like, they seem to get on. He's really nice and pleasant and seems to have some affection for Elizabeth. But Mr. Darcy has money.
Oh, it's such a good like view into Charlotte's character, because we already know she's very pragmatic and realistic. And we have this moment where she's like, where she talks about him being in love with Elizabeth. Like, she says like, well, he must be in love with you. Like, she doesn't say like, oh, he must want to marry you. Like, she's like, he must be in love with you. And then in her mind, she's like, well, he would be a better catch because he like has more money and all this kind of stuff. So it's such
Fitzwilliam, not so much.
Yeah. Charlotte's such a good friend. I like her a lot.
She wants her friend taken care of. Mm-hmm. Ugh. Charlotte's great.
Yeah, so we get now Elizabeth runs into Colonel Fitzwilliam, who kind of spills the beans here on his friend preventing a bad marriage in a very interesting scene that's like very upsetting.
Colonel Fitzwilliam is like one of the many people that we run into who think very highly of Darcy, not just because of his money, but because of the person he is. He, you know, he's got shared custody of Darcy's sister Georgiana, and he is like the eldest, and Fitzwilliam is just a second son, I think, in his family. So it makes sense that he would defer to Darcy most of the time, but it seems like he really does respect his cousin. And one of the things that he recommends to Darcy's integrity as a person is that he saved one of his friends that he presumes is Bingley, doesn't know for certain, but he presumes is Bingley, from a disastrous sort of engagement.
This is so bad.
It hurts, because this is Fitzwilliam being like, no, he's a really good guy. He saved his friend from this inopportune situation, and wow, he's great. And meanwhile, Elizabeth is sitting there seething, going, oh no.
Oh yes, said Elizabeth dryly. Mr. Darcy is uncommonly kind to Mr. Bingley and takes prodigious care of him. Like, it's so, and Colonel Fitzwilliam's like, yeah, he does. It's like not getting it at all. Like, she's being sarcastic.
One of my favorite moments, though, is when Elizabeth asks if they leave Kent on Saturday, and Fitzwilliam says, yes, if Darcy does not put it off again. And I'm like,
Oh my God, I missed that. I missed that entirely.
Why do you keep staying? Because if you're so bored that you're just dropping by on Elizabeth to talk about nothing.
Oh, I love that. I totally miss that. I've read this book so many times and I completely miss that.
It's I love that there's some very obvious moments where you're like, Darcy is into her. And other times you're like, Darcy is into her. These little small things. I really like Fitzwilliam.
Yeah, it's interesting that some, like, the two of the most, to borrow a word from the book, right, the most amiable men that we meet are Bingley and Colonel Fitzwilliam, and they both think the world of Darcy, this, like, jerk, right? And even Wickham, who we meet and we're told over and over again how charming he is, how attractive he is, and even Elizabeth calls him, like, amiable. I don't know if we get the same, like, Fitzwilliam and Bingley are just, like, by far, the loveliest men in the book. I think it's telling that they're, like, Darcy's best friends. You know, you can like tell like the person, who the person is, like sort of based on the company that they keep. And I mean, we'll learn more about like the Bingley stuff later, but it's just interesting that here we are meeting like another lovely man and he's like obsessed with Darcy.
And Bingley seems more like a bit of a pushover.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you get to Colonel Fitzwilliam, you're like, he's probably like a solid judge of character. It's not him being like just, oh, this rich guy is paying attention to me, or he's my like amazing cousin that I'd have always looked up to. So at this point, you think, you know, there's something to this guy. There was also a moment when Fitzwilliam was talking about being the younger son of an heir. And at some point, Fitzwilliam says something like, you know, perhaps I cannot say that I have had. Hold on. They're talking about Darcy. When is Elizabeth not talking about Darcy, it seems? And Fitzwilliam is kind of defending him. He says, you know, he likes to have his own way very well, which we obviously all knew, but we all do. It is only that he has better means of having it than many others because he is rich and many others are poor. Kind of appreciate him pointing out the privilege there. And Elizabeth actually calls him out on that. But, oh, yes. Yeah. So she says, you know, in my opinion, the younger son of an heir can know very little of either. Now, seriously, what have you ever known of self-denial and dependence? Have you been prevented by want of money from going wherever you choose or procuring anything you had a fancy for? And Fitzwilliam acknowledges, you know, perhaps I cannot say that I've experienced many hardships of that nature, but in matters of greater weight, I may suffer from want of money. Younger sons cannot marry where they like. Our habits of expense make us too dependent, and there are too many in my rank of life who can afford to marry without some attention to money. And Elizabeth thinks, is this meant for me? And she colored at the idea. So she's a little aware for all her denial of Darcy. She's like, she's a little aware when men are like, so I'm talking about money and marriage to a woman I am not related to.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I kind of read over that part too. I had underlined the sentence, younger men cannot, sons cannot marry where they like. And I think it did sort of resonate like, oh yeah, he's like telling her he likes her, but sort of being like, I can't be with you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just very interesting because I really like that back and forth there.
They have like an easy kind of dynamic too. Not, you know, as heated mm-hmm. or bantery or passionate like with Elizabeth and Darcy. But there's something nice here that's a bit reminiscent of Wickham, but it's clearly, it doesn't have a weird undertone to it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. And we get that she's like a desirable woman. It's like very clear to us, you know, she's very pretty and people keep commenting on it. And we have Wickham who might not be like the best guy, but he is, you know, he likes her. And then Fitzwilliam likes her and we like Fitzwilliam. And then Darcy obviously likes her. So no, I kind of like that. I always sort of gloss over it when I'm reading, but it is a very interesting detail.
And later on, it says, to interrupt a silence which might make him fancy her, affected with what had passed. She soon afterwards said, I imagine your cousin brought you down with him chiefly for the sake of having someone at his disposal. I wonder he does not marry to secure a lasting convenience of that kind. But perhaps his sister does as well for the present. And as she is under his sole care, he may do what he likes with her. I like that she does think that, is he falling for me? I'm going to just talk right now so it doesn't happen.
That's very relatable. But yeah, no, it's a very interesting chapter. And it's interesting that we hear about this from a character that we like and that we trust. But it does paint a very bad picture for Darcy. It's very bad timing.
Yeah, it does. And we don't have any denial about who Georgiana is as a person because Elizabeth brings her up too. Young ladies of her age are sometimes a little difficult to manage. And if she has the true Darcy spirit, she may like to have her own way. She assumes Fitzwilliam's lack of response confirms her belief because he doesn't really say anything. He just kind of keeps like chugging along talking about Bingley and how Darcy saved him from a bad marriage.
And I like that, you know, he never, you know, says it's Bingley, but then later she like goes over and over in her head about what happened. And she's very like upset, obviously. And she's very upset for Jane. And she's like going through like everything that happened. And she's like, I just don't understand like why he would have done that. And then she thinks about her mother and her confidence gave way a little bit, but she would not allow mm-hmm. that any objections there had material weight with Darcy. So it's just, she is kind of in denial here.
Yeah. And she has to kind of, as you said, like go over the details, and he doesn't confirm it was Bingley. He probably shouldn't suppose it's Bingley because he never said for sure that it was. But that phrase, I understood that there were some very strong objections against the lady. That phrase just really hits with Elizabeth too, because she's like, it's Jane. Jane is perfect.
Yeah.
She loves Jane. She's like the president of the Jane Bennett fan club.
I know. And then she like literally like the next chapter starts with her like going through her letters, all of Jane's letters, to be like, in each line there was want of that cheerfulness which used to characterize her style. And, you know, Darcy's shameful boast of what misery had been able to inflict gave her a keener sense of her sister's suffering. It's just so bad timing. It makes me wonder, Darcy's proposal, which we're getting into, happens like almost immediately after this. So it's just like the worst timing. So I always sort of wonder, like, if she hadn't heard that, if she would have said no still. I mean, probably they wouldn't have had like their big fight, but
maybe not as strongly.
Yeah, but it's just like the worst. He has like the worst timing.
I mean, we've seen so many times before that Elizabeth determines how she feels about some people based on how they treat her sister, and her sister Jane is all loveliness and goodness as she is, her understanding excellent, her mind improved and her manners captivating. Neither could be urged against my father, who, though with some peculiarities, has abilities Mr. Darcy himself need not disdain, and respectability which he will probably never reach. She just can't accept it. She can't accept it at all that anyone would have any real reservations about Jane. And it's insane. I think at some point they also mentioned that like the only misgivings that you could possibly have about Jane's family is that her uncle is an attorney and her other one does business in London.
Yeah, it's not the best like introspection, but I'll forgive her because no one wants to like think like ill about their family. And she'll soon very much like get like a letter literally like spelling it out for her. So, but anyway, so do you want to, should we dive into the proposal?
Oh, let's do it.
He like barges in.
First, the doorbell rings and she thinks it's going to be Fitzwilliam and she's really excited about it, even though that he doesn't seem to be like trying to court her or anything, but it's just Darcy.
And I like the touch that he barges in and he sits down and then he gets up and walks about the room and she's just like pacing and she's just flabbergasted and like doesn't say a word. And then he comes with this line, which like I could quote from memory: in vain if I struggled, it will not do, my feelings will not be repressed, you must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. And she's like astonished beyond expression, and she just like stares at him silently. What's very interesting to me is that we don't get exactly what he says here. All we get is that he spoke well, and there were feelings besides the heart to be detailed, and he was not more eloquent on the subject of tenderness than of pride. And we get it, like, spelled out. You know, his sense of her inferiority, of it being her degradation, of the family obstacles, the judgment, were dwelt on with warmth, which seemed due to the consequence he was wounding, but very unlikely to recommend his suit. We don't get words here. We just get a description of the words, which I find fascinating. And I don't know why. Maybe because she's so shocked and that she can only sort of get feeling of it and that's all we get as the reader. I don't know.
It is really interesting. This is actually not even the first time this happens to Darcy in this specific chunk of chapters that we covered, because at some point Lady Catherine's just like, oh, how are Georgiana's practices going? And they're like, well, he describes how our practices went and we moved on, which was kind of great. I mean, maybe it is because later on, we also, you know, she throws back everything he says back at him. So it kind of, it prevents it from being repeated, because I was wondering about that too.
And like immediately after, we get her internal monologue, because she says, you know, in spite of her deeply rooted dislike, she could not be insensible to the compliment of such a man's affections. And though her intentions did not vary for an instant, she was at first very sorry for the pain he was about to receive, till roused by resentment of his subsequent language, she lost all compassion and anger. Maybe we're not really getting the words, because all we're getting is like her inside Elizabeth's mind, where she's like hearing him talk about her family and she's getting like madder and madder, and she's sort of, how am I going to let him down easily? And then she's like, oh wait, like I'm not going to let him down easily. So we're getting more her perspective on it, which would make sense and I get it, but it's interesting because the book, you know, we've gotten Charlotte's point of view, at times we even got like a sentence of Darcy's point of view. So the book is not consistently in Elizabeth's POV, but it is in this scene, which makes sense because of the proposal. But it's always fascinating to me every time I read it that we don't really get the words he says. We just get the impressions of them.
I was going to ask you about that because in the earlier chapters, we did have so much more insight on what's going on with Darcy internally and how he feels about Elizabeth. So is it just because we presume that he just still feels the same? Do you wish that we got more of what he thinks and how he's reacting inside to how Elizabeth treats him? Or do you think we get enough, like, context clues?
I think we do get a lot of context clues. I mean, here, you know, as he's talking to her and, like, asking her to marry him, essentially, she says, you know, she could see that he had no doubt of a favorable answer. He spoke of apprehension and anxiety, but his countenance expressed real security. And we get, like, a couple, I think when she, like, initially turns him down, she says that the color, like, drains from his cheeks and you know, she can tell when he's angry or not.
I really like that Mr. Darcy, who was leaning against the mantelpiece with his eyes fixed on her face. I love that he was just posing the whole time. Yeah. Waiting.
I mean, it's so good because you can, even though you don't know exactly what he's saying, you can, like, picture it so well and, like, whether or not that's me just, like, projecting, like, the various, like, adaptions. But I really do think that the scene is written sort of like a play. Even if you aren't getting, like, the exact words he's saying, it's just like a fascinating proposal scene, and I enjoy being inside Elizabeth's head here probably more than I would enjoy being inside of Darcy's, because he probably is like, okay, she's definitely going to say yes, like, she has to because she's poor and she has to get married, and so he's sort of like using that, you know, as a given so he can unleash all of his feelings. And I do think that we get a lot of what he was feeling, like, later in the letter.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't necessarily need him to spell it out for us all right here. And he's not really a man of many words, I guess. So I don't necessarily mind not being in his head because we do get enough by context clues. But I just think it's so interesting that we are just getting Elizabeth's perspective here.
It's such a change from what we saw just from in, like, Sense and Sensibility, the previous book, and, like, how much more we do get things shown to us instead of told to us, or just we don't see it until later on when it's explained to us. I really love that.
Yeah, I mean, the proposal is a surprise to us as well as her, even if we are a little bit more onto the fact that he clearly likes her. But we don't get... Mm-hmm. Is so interesting because literally the scene before this is an instance where we find out that Darcy separated his friend, not even his, you know, his brother or like a cousin, like his friend Bingley. He didn't want Bingley to be married to Jane, presumably at this point in the story, because Jane's family's not good enough. And then immediately after, Darcy wants to be married to Elizabeth, like in her family, like the same family that was so awful to him that he separated his friend. And I mean, he says later, you know, like, I was so generous to my friend to save him the same fate that I was gonna like let myself have. So he like acknowledges the hypocrisy, but it's just so funny to me, the sequence of events that happen and how he just goes about it so terribly.
He's not great at it, no.
And this is the second proposal Elizabeth's gotten in the book. Like, she was proposed to by Mr. Collins, and this is the second time she said no. Is there anything that you can, like, compare and contrast of the two proposals? I mean, they're both, like, men that are think they're in positions of power, and they think that they're going to be said yes to.
They're not great at reading a room.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you said, they both are in a position of power. And they both have, I guess we can say, an entitlement and assuming that she would say yes because she's a woman and because they have, you know, a livelihood to depend on that most women would be after. It is interesting, though, that they both kind of do this thing where they think they're saying something nice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But they're also incredibly insulting about it. Collins does think he's like complimenting her, like actually complimenting her and being kind of coy and in on the joke. And Darcy himself, though, his reaction is very, oh, okay. But he does actually take his rejection a lot better than Collins does, because Collins at first is kind of disbelieving and then in shock. And then afterwards, he's a little petty about it, but... Darcy at the end, and I mean, I'm skipping so much just to bring all of this up, but in the end, you know, he says, "You have said quite enough, madam. I perfectly comprehend your feelings and have only to be ashamed for what my own have been. Forgive me for having taken up so much of your time and accept my best wishes for your health and happiness."
Yeah, the only time he gets really mad is when she mentions Wickham.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's just not taking like the rejection like super well, but he's like clearly mad. Like his complexion became pale with anger and the disturbance of his mind was visible and he's struggling for composure, but he's, you know, like, well, why am I rejected? And, you know, she explains it, but it's only when she mentions Wickham and he goes, "You take an eager interest in that gentleman's concern," said Darcy in a less tranquil tone and with heightened color. And then he goes, "His misfortunes," repeated Darcy contemptuously. "Yes, his misfortunes have been great indeed. And this," cried Darcy as he walked with quick steps across the room, "is your opinion of me. This is an estimation which you hold me. I thank you for explaining it so fully."
The sarcasm.
That's when he gets like really mad. And I mean, he's jealous of Wickham, like clearly, which is like very petty and like adorable. I'm sorry. I know jealousy isn't always adorable, but in this case, it kind of
just feels a lot of things like this is like cutting him deep, real deep.
So it's interesting that like he's able to like take her rejection, like he's struggling to be calm and like figure it out and sort of rationalize it, but he doesn't get like angry, and you know that he's so you kind of like find out like this is what he's capable of. He's capable of getting like really angry in relation to Wickham, and you find out why
it's such a raw nerve for him. One of my favorite lines though, because you know she's yelling at him, you know, and she's being all like, "Why, with so evident a desire of offending and insulting me, you choose to tell me that you'd like me against your will, against your reason, and even against your character." And all this stuff he takes, you know, in stride. Not great, you know, as she pronounced these words, Mr. Darcy changed color, but the emotion was short. And he listened without attempt to interrupt her while he continued. And I bolded that line and I said, what a surprisingly hot line. A man who just like sit and listen to what you're saying and taking it in before replying. And I'm like, that's really nice. I was like, I'm going to give that one to Darcy. He's a man who does listen.
It is interesting because she starts being, you know, somewhat civil. Like, I'm sure you'll get over it. I can't accept you. Like, this is laughable. And then it escalates at the end to her being like, you could have not have made the offer of your hand in any possible way that would have tempted me to accept it. And then he goes, his astonishment was obvious. He looked at her with expression of mingled incredulity and mortification. And it's like there that he's just completely blown over. And she goes, you're the last man in the world whom I could ever be prevailed on to marry. So it goes from like flattery to like just like their tempers both super escalate here.
Yeah. There's just like a lot of feelings going on. And later, you know, like you said, in the next chapter, we find out just why Darcy reacted the way he did, why everything was like fine and he could handle this and he'll be a grown up. He'll be a hurt grown up, but he'll do it until Wickham's name comes up.
I think the way they both like handled the situation, because it obviously like escalates to the point where they're both like not being super rational. That's why I think the letter hits as well as it does, because Darcy's able to calm down and think about it and write out his thoughts and feelings in a way that Elizabeth can read without the heightened emotion behind it. Sorry to be like cliche about this, but like the way they both react, I think really reflects like the title of the book, right? Because like she wounds his pride, which like gets him like really mad, and she can't really see beyond her prejudice of him in this scene. So it's just like they don't like say the words, you know, like this is because of your pride and this is because of your prejudice, but like it's like inherent like in there, and that's why it's just such a good title, even though it's just like two words.
It plays for me this very fine balance of, wow, they're really like impassioned and so alike in a way that it must mean that they're perfect for each other, but maybe they're almost too alike, where it's hard to see, like, you almost wonder, would this actually be able to work out, or would this just be constant anguish and fighting? Because that can only take you so far sometimes.
I like that he does say that he's like, I'm not ashamed of how I feel. Like, my feelings are natural. Like, I love you.
Yeah.
And he, like, doesn't back down from that, which I kind of love.
Yeah, he's just like, I'm just, like, pointing out the fact that everyone else is going to say this, too.
It's, like, it's a bad scene for Darcy, but at the same time, you're like, okay, you love her this much that you're willing to overlook all these things in your mind that are so horrible. I don't know. I'm being, like, way too generous to him. Like, he's insulting her family. Like, it's not great.
He really is. I do like, though, that at the same time he does at some point seem to be like, okay, this is what you think. I'm not going to change your mind. This is the end of the conversation. I'm going to leave it politely. Which is something I don't always have the ability to do myself. So I'm going to show some respect for that. And then afterwards, we're just kind of stuck in Elizabeth's mind. And obviously this is like, you know, if you're anything like me, I can't get an argument out of my head, even like a really small one, and it'll pop up in my head like a year later. The tumult of her mind was not painfully great. She knew not how to support herself, and from actual weakness sat down and cried for half an hour. Her astonishment as she reflected on what had passed was increased by every review of it, that she should receive an offer of marriage from Mr. Darcy, that he should have been in love with her for so many months, so much in love as to wish to marry her in spite of all the objections which had made him prevent his friends marrying her sister, mm-hmm. and which must appear, at least with equal force in his own case, was almost incredible. Yeah, I thought that was a really good point to make, that she made herself like, oh, the reasons why he separated Bingley and Jane, you know, he was so objective about it for Bingley, or in his mind objective about it, but he can't do that through want of love of me. Interesting.
Yeah, no, it's, I like that we get like the sort of after for her, like her just being like just so astonished and like weirdly flattered and like so upset. And she does mention pride here, you know, but his pride, his abdominal pride, is shameless of all of what he'd done with respect to Jane. She's just like feeling just like all the feelings here, like all of them.
So many feelings. Yeah. But she still just like is really determined to dislike Darcy after all that, because he was so pleased with himself for having, for what he did with Jane and Bingley. And just the way he talked about Wickham, when he was clearly the bad guy, how is he talking about him so angrily? Like, he's not the one who ruined everything.
No, it's the proposal scene's so iconic. And it sort of like is what, you know, like we talked about before we got into it. It's what you think about when you think about Pride and Prejudice. And, you know, I could read this, you know, next week and come up with different stuff to say. Like, I just think there's so much here that it's impossible to exhaust like every angle. It's just such a good scene mm-hmm. in its like horribleness.
And you kind of like almost want to break after that, don't you? You're like, whoa, that was a lot. Tempers are running high. So she like tries to take a walk, as she is wont to do, as many women in Austen books often are.
Hey, I'm walking a lot now. Like, I feel like we're taking like walks in the wilderness a lot now.
They're really nice. I accidentally took one not long ago for like 4 hours. I was very tired by it. I'd never walked that much in my life. But so she nearly takes a walk through the park that she had told Darcy that she loves to walk through, but she's too afraid of running into him there. And then she sees this guy who's like, oh, maybe this is him. I'm going to go the other way. And she was going to walk away, but the person who advanced was now near enough to see her, and stepping forward with eagerness, pronounced her name. And she's like, oh, someone's calling me. Never mind, I'm coming. And it's like, oh, it's him. With a letter. This
letter's so romantic. And she like immediately reads it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. And before then, he's like, he said with a look of haughty composure, I have been walking in the grove some time now in the hope of meeting you. Will you do me the honor of reading the letter? He waited for her.
He's still in love with her. Loves her so
He's
much.
He's so in love with her. I'm going to try to avoid reading this entire letter aloud, but I love that it starts with, be not alarmed, madam, on receiving this letter by the apprehension of its containing any repetition of those sentiments or renewal of those offers which were last night so disgusting to you. I love that so much. She's like, okay, first of all, calm down. I'm not going to like tell you I love you again.
Oh, it's so good. And I love how she like greedily like opens the letter. She's like, I got to read it right now. Like, I was like, yeah, girl, like you do have to read it right now.
But it's mostly just like, let's pretend that didn't happen. But perhaps his pride is just like, okay, I took a step back. I'm still not gonna like force you into anything, but I need you to know my truth. Possibly for his own pride personally. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't necessarily need to be like, oh, you deserve the truth, but I feel like part of it is I need you to like judge me on what really happened mm-hmm. for my own vanity's sake.
The letter is very interesting, and it's interesting also how letters are used in other Austen properties. I mean, we've only really read Sense and Sensibility so far officially mm-hmm. through the podcast, but even in that book, like, letters are really important. We find out about Willoughby's shittiness, for lack of a better word, through these letters that they send. Like, here Austen, like, she gives us an entire chapter for this letter versus other times where we've read Jane's letters and we get what Elizabeth thinks about the letter rather than what the context of the letter is. So here it's just, this is kind of the calling card. This is a very important letter. Like, this is the turning point of the book. We're like halfway through. At this point, Elizabeth's gotten two proposals. The contents of the letter are very important, and it's very, what's the word I'm looking for? Very projected, like, importance.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that a lot of the things from the letter, like, we don't necessarily always get the entire letter in adaptations, but parts of it have been lifted for the actual dialogue. Like, the things that Darcy says. I love that that's how it gets used, that people fill in the part where she doesn't write out Darcy's dialogue in the book, but it gets, it's still, we still find something.
No, I think we get a lot of the things that he doesn't say, or we don't hear him say in the proposal scene, we get like spelled out. It's sort of like three phases, right? We have Colonel Fitzwilliam telling Elizabeth that Darcy broke up Bingley and Jane because there was like a lot of, for many reasons, I guess, but like one of the reasons was the family. The second part is Elizabeth thinking back and being like, there was nothing about my family that was offensive. Like maybe my mom, like a little bit, whatever. I can't think about that. But then we get this letter where we have his sort of point of view. And I think in a lot of adaptions, they flash back to the parties. And so you sort of see in the mind how it would have looked from the outside for her mother to be talking so loudly, like, Jane's gonna be married to Bingley, and how like that would look to Darcy sitting right there a little bit more from Darcy's point of view. You know, you're not gonna be like, Elizabeth's family sucks from what Darcy has to say because he's a snob, but you do get more of a sense. And even because he even calls out her father, the lack of propriety.
Oh, I love that part.
Because remember, her father like insults Mary in front of everybody, and it's really awkward.
Yeah, I love that he even points out, like, because, you know, Mr. Bennet, Mrs. Bennet, all these crazy hijinks that happen to the family and that things that Elizabeth are afraid are actually embarrassing. From her perspective, it's actually kind of funny or kind of charming. But from an outsider, you're like, we don't actually know who these people are. So it just looks ambitious in the wrong kind of way. It does seem insincere. It does seem like not a thing you want your best friend to be around.
And similarly, in the same way, it's how Darcy views Jane, because Elizabeth knows Jane so well, so she knows that she's in love with Bingley. But then you have Darcy's perspective, because your sister I watched, her looks and her manners were open, cheerful, and engaging as ever, but without any symptom of peculiar regard. And I remain convinced from the evening scrutiny that though she received his attentions with pleasure, she did not invite them by participation of sentiment. And you have Darcy saying, like, I didn't believe these things just because I willed it. And it's, you know, it sounds like really weak in the letter, because you're like, yeah, you didn't want her to be with him, so you read into her expressions. But if you go back in the book, remember Charlotte told Elizabeth, Jane doesn't seem like she's in love with Bingley. So this is just sort of like building on that. You have another example of someone pointing out to Elizabeth, it doesn't seem like your sister's in love with him. Like, she should really be showing more affection. And Elizabeth being like, no, 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 no. Like, you don't understand Jane. But from an outsider's point of view, and even Charlotte, who's not really even an outsider, you know, like, Elizabeth can't be in such denial. Like, yes, she knows her sister really well, and she knows her family really well. But here's this guy kind of piggybacking off of what her really good friend said. Jane didn't look like she was super in love with Bingley from the outside to anybody, even people that knew her.
Yeah. And I mean, Jane is not the most, she's polite to everyone. She just is. She's kind of an internal person herself, and she shares stuff with Elizabeth. But I mean, that's in a lot of ways the same kind of person that Darcy is. He's very internal, and like things slip through, and he probably thinks he's being super obvious. But unless you know the person, unless you've watched them, or you're looking for something like Charlotte does when she's watching Darcy, it can be really easy to miss. And Bingley had before believed Jane to return his affection with sincere, if not equal, regard. But Bingley has great natural modesty with a stronger dependence on Darcy's judgment than his own. And it convinced him, therefore, that he had deceived himself. That I like definitely copied this down wrong. But basically, you know, Bingley was like, oh, I really did just convince myself that she liked me as much as I liked her. And it wasn't that hard, because Bingley just needs to believe in himself more, I guess.
I mean, because Darcy says, he's like, I've seen Bingley in love before, but then he saw him with Miss Bennet, and he said, I perceive that his partiality for Miss Bennet was beyond what I had witnessed in him. So Darcy does, he's going about it in like a crappy way, and like I do think that he was biased a little bit in reading too much into Jane's expressions, but he was looking out for his friend, both on the family end, which I don't really appreciate, but then also like, he didn't think that Jane was as interested, and he saw that his friend was very interested. So he was looking out for his friend. And then he sort of ruins it by saying, like, he didn't tell Bingley that Jane was in town.
Yeah, that does make it. I mean, it is, you could still paint that as him trying to, like, protect his friend. But it didn't help that he and Caroline were like, yeah, we need to separate these two, and they join forces.
I want to be careful because I do think I'm sort of like biased for Darcy. You know, I love them, Elizabeth and Darcy. I want them to be together. I think they're cute. I think they're and so I don't want to just absolve him completely in the letter, because it was like very shitty of him to step in. It was shitty of him to talk a lot of crap about her family. You know, they're her family. And it was the worst that he kept Bingley from seeing Jane when she was in town.
He did lie about that. Mm-hmm. That is manipulative.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you know, as we pointed out before, what Elizabeth said, that he felt so strongly about this enough to keep Jane and Bingley apart, but not so strongly enough that when he was the one who was in love with someone mm-hmm. with the same family, he's still like, hey, what's up? You want to get married?
Yeah. And then we get the Wickham stuff.
Dun, dun.
Do they give her the sound effect?
I mean, everything does make more sense when you put it like that. It's really just, not only is it a really awful thing that Wickham does, the fact that he's going around being like, oh, I'm so slighted. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to say that Darcy's a bad dude, but he did like bad dude stuff to me.
Yeah. And this is another situation where if we just had the letter, if we just had Darcy's word against Wickham, I would be sort of conflicted here. I'd be like, well, yeah, like this is a crappy story. And, you know, of course, Fitzwilliam will just back up his friend. But at the same time, you know, we also have Mrs. Gardiner being like, Wickham's sort of a sketchy dude, like maybe back off a little bit. We also get him ditching Elizabeth for this like richer other woman. And Elizabeth laughs it off. But these are just a lot of circumstantial evidence against Wickham that's backed up by the story in the letter.
And we've never gotten anything from Darcy that he's a liar. He may be unpleasant. He may be a snob. He may be arrogant and he may be proud, but he has not been shown to be a liar.
Mm-hmm. And I think it would be possible to read this letter and still come out of it being like, well, Darcy sucks. He's lying. He's just like sticking up for himself. But at this time, he has nothing left to lose. Like, she's already told him no. He's not asking her again. He's just sort of explaining himself. And he's not like coming off great in the letter. He's not like ingratiating himself on him. Like, I'm so sorry about what I did. No, he's like, this is me explaining, being pretty matter of fact.
He does apologize for the things that he says that will offend her. There's a certain integrity to it where he's like, this is what I did. This is why I did it. It was all in loyalty to someone I cared about deeply.
Mm-hmm. And it's like embarrassing for him to admit it. You know, like my sister like ran off with him and like I wasn't able to stop it. And so I think there is a lot of weight that we can give this letter. It's not just this biased, angry, diatribe, passionate thing. It's very practical, and I think we have to give it a lot of weight. Like, we have to believe him, essentially.
I mean, he waited to give her this letter, too. He wasn't just like, here, bye.
And it makes sense, like, why he'd be so mad at Wickham. Because, like, we saw in the proposal, like, we made a point to acknowledge that he only gets, like, really mad when she brings up Wickham. Why would Wickham not go to that party? Like, he clearly, like, is afraid of Darcy. So, I'm done now. I'm sorry.
He knows he's in the wrong. And I do love that when you look back at the proposal and everything, and you, after reading this chapter, and you realize that both of them are just kind of like, this would be fine. We would either deal with this whole being in love thing, or talk about it, or be at least very civil with each other. But you mentioned someone's sister.
Yeah.
And all civility goes out the window, and they're like, no, look, we're gonna fight now.
Yeah.
You made my sister unhappy. You like this guy who nearly ruined my sister. We're not gonna be calm about it. If it's just me, that's fine. But this girl that I think the world of, no. And I really love that. It does make all their like kind of awfulness to each other in the proposal fine to me.
Yeah. I mean, I still do want to be careful because I, you know, like Mr. Darcy so much in retrospect, I don't want to absolve him of like the shitty stuff he does, because he does.
Yeah.
He still like puts his foot in it. But at the same time, like, we know that Wickham is like a fortune hunter. We know that he's maybe not like the best guy. And yeah, Darcy does a lot here in this letter, and we have yet to read Elizabeth's real reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just, these chapters are just so interesting together, the proposal into this. And we can't say much more without like just completely spoiling.
But it does, yeah, it adds to the greater picture of Darcy that we have, and of Wickham, obviously, who was just too beautiful to be trusted.
Yes, well, I think we've come across a lot of men in Austen's books that are too beautiful to be trusted. So if we ever get a character that's just like on and on about how handsome they are, we can immediately be like, okay, this guy's sketchy.
That or a priest.
True, or both.
Ugh.
But I feel like we're at a big turning point in the story. Like, this is, we're about halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of getting more explanation here. And it's sort of like they're both pissed off and prideful, and the letter is sort of the beginning of a humbling, because Darcy's like putting it all out there, you know, a lot of embarrassing things, and he's like, I'm gonna let you be the judge here. You can talk about it with people if you want.
It's kind of going, it kind of goes both ways in this too, where they're both sort of understanding where the other person is coming from, even if it's not, wasn't necessarily the most accurate thing, but it is not just them bantering or yelling at each other. It is just an understanding that the other person is coming from a real genuine place, as opposed to just being a total prejudiced snob that like, oh, he's rich and arrogant, I don't like him. Oh, she's from like a poor family and who just wants to make money. It's actually like they have real intentions and motivations and agency and feel the way they do for a reason. Wrong reason, maybe.
Yeah. And to use like the title again, like prejudice, right? Elizabeth judged Wickham in a certain way and she judged Darcy in a certain way. And it takes... She's sort of confronted here by an opportunity to go back and rejudge, kind of like go back and rethink about how she views these people. And, you know, she's had people in her life, you know, smart people, you know, her aunt and Charlotte question the integrity, you know, the motives. And so this is just kind of like the, not maybe not the last one, but just some more evidence for her to kind of go back and
reevaluate.
Yeah, reevaluate. That's exactly what I'm looking for. You know, Mr. Darcy's pride was ruined or, you know, hurt when she turned him down. And so he like is sort of laying himself bare. You know, these are all my thoughts and feelings. I'm not going to sugarcoat them for you. This is it. This is me. This is my explanation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to seeing how she views the letter.
I think it's a really good turning point. You're like when they're actually communicating and telling each other what mm-hmm. they think and feel, that's probably a good thing, that that's an important moment.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have some more chapters to go.
Yes. Yeah, so anyway, this has been a long, we've talked a lot. So is there anything else you want to say about these chapters before we wrap it up?
You know what? I think... probably.
Yeah,
I probably
yeah, we're do have more to say so about much. It.
But
yeah.
I think it's probably good for now. And Lord knows, like, with everything running at such a high degree right now, you know, there's going to be more to talk about in the coming sections.
And if we missed anything, like, please let us know. I'm like very curious to see like other people's perspective on these scenes, just because they're so iconic and they're so important in this book. And I know that a lot of people have a lot of feelings.
Yeah, if this isn't enough for you to start forgiving Darcy, let us know why.
Yes, please.
If you think that Elizabeth is still being dumb, who do you want to play Colonel Fitzwilliam?
Yes, your ideal Colonel Fitzwilliam. Should Elizabeth have just run off with Colonel Fitzwilliam and like that would have been the end of the book? Let us know.
It seems like a nice, reliable choice.
Then it wouldn't be like the great one of the great romances, probably.
Probably not, but it'd be one that Charlotte could approve of.
True. We're all a Charlotte.
I think I am a Charlotte.
Charlotte's the best.
So next time we'll be doing chapters 36 through 40. What are you looking forward to next time? As if I need to ask.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, I'm looking forward to seeing kind of Elizabeth's reaction post-letter. Is she going to tell people? Is she going to tell Jane? Is she going to see Darcy again? I'm looking forward to you know, we kept saying this is a turning point. So I'm looking forward to delving into that, the new frontier with you. This new world post-proposal.
And plus we have so many people just kind of floating around in the wind that aren't Jane or Elizabeth or a Darcy.
That's true.
So something may come up from there. Jessie, where can people find us?
We have a website, thedailynightly.com. We have a Twitter, nightlypod. We have an Instagram, thedailynightly. And we have an email, thedailynightly@gmail.com. Please write us. Remember, nightly spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-L-E-Y.
Also, you can hear me ramble about Mad Men on a little podcast called Still Great Bob that I do with some friends of ours as we rewatch all of Mad Men through the 2020 lens. Woo! We love to hear from you guys. thank you again to Tiffany for your awesome email, and we hope to talk to you next time.
Happy reading, everybody. Stay safe.
Happy reading.